Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Yaa Jossi was born in Ghana, and her family moved to the United States when she was 2 years old. Her birth country figures prominently in her two books, Homegoing and her latest, Transcendent Kingdom. Yaa appeared at a virtual National Writer Series event. She spoke with Detroit's Director of Arts and Culture, Rochelle Riley. Rochelle asked Yaa how she decided to write Homegoing.
Well, you know, they always say that it takes you your entire life to write your first book, or that you were working toward your first book for, you know, your entire life until that book comes out. And that felt very true for me. Homegoing is very much a book that aims to, I think, examine identity, particularly Ghanaian and American identity. It questions what it means to have inherited this legacy of slavery and colonialism. It attempts to kind of look at the diaspora as a family. And I wrote it in great part because I had always felt as though I was kind of existing in these liminal spaces. For those who don't know, Homegoing is a novel that follows the family lineage of two half-sisters born in the Gold Coast in the 18th century. One of the sisters lives in the Cape Coast Castle, which is a slave fort, as the wife of the British governor of that castle. The other sister is kept in that same castle as an enslaved woman before being sent to America. And the novel moves generation by generation down to the last one. And I think that I wrote it because, well, for so many reasons, but one of the reasons was that, you know, my family had come to America and we had ended up in Alabama, where, you know, the effects of the slave trade were still so strongly felt in these kind of keen, observable ways. And the fact that I came from a country that had this castle, it has other castles too, but these monuments to slavery that still sit on Ghanaian land, I really wanted to kind of interrogate those links. And so my sophomore year of college, I got this research grant to travel to Ghana and conduct research for a novel. At the time, I had a totally different idea in mind. But then my friend Stefan came to visit. He wanted to go see the Cape Coast Castle. We went, we took the tour that they give to anyone. The Obamas had actually just been there the week before us on tour. So there was like a lot of fanfare around the castle. And it's the only time in my writing life where I felt anything akin to a stroke of inspiration. I just knew immediately that I wanted to write about this place, what had taken place there. It felt haunted, and I felt haunted by the story.
How overwhelming was the praise? I mean, everybody wants whatever book they write to be, you know, embraced and beloved and make the New York Times bestseller list. But talk for a little bit about what that was like.
Overwhelming indeed. It was, you know, I always say it feels like writing the first book feels like you're writing in the dark, completely unsure about whether or not your book will ever see the light of day. And the fact that my book not only saw light, but that that light was so bright was more than I could have ever dreamed of or imagined. And I felt incredibly fortunate, filled with kind of gratitude for all of the people who had taken me seriously over the years, taken my dreams seriously over the years, and certainly some amount of nervousness and just kind of pressure as well. But it was an experience that is really one in a million. And I'm so thankful that people responded to the book with so much love.
Well, it is absolute love. And I'll only ask one more question about the old book before we talk about the new book.
Sure.
You do have that type of overwhelming praise and you've written something that magnificent. How soon did you think you'd be ready to write the next book and how much trepidation was there about that?
Yeah, I was really surprised by how long it took me to work my way into the second novel, because I am a person who has always written, really, since I was a child. I had always been kind of working on something or thinking about something. And after Homegoing, suddenly I found myself with this entirely new role, which was the role that I hadn't considered as part of the career of a writer, this kind of public-facing role. And so suddenly I was doing things that I had never done before, events and tours, traveling, staying in hotels, ordering lots of room service. And that kind of that busyness and also that kind of noisy excitement, I think it took me a while to return to the quietude, I think, that you need in order to write another book. So once I started teaching myself just how to say no to things, how to carve out time for myself to write, but also how to kind of listen to myself and listen to that voice in my head that is seeking out a story, suddenly all of the rest of it kind of fell away and I was able to actually write this book. But it took me several months. I would say Homegoing came out in 2016 and I started writing this early 2017. So about 6 months of no writing, which was rare for me.
Well, now let's get into this book, Transcendent Kingdom, which, as I told you when I first met you, was transcendent. Mm-hmm. It is totally different from the historical fiction of the first book. So can you talk a little bit, so all of these people who are going to buy this book at an independent bookstore first thing tomorrow can have a glimpse at what it's like?
Sure. So Transcendent Kingdom is about a woman named Gifty who is getting her doctorate in neuroscience, and she studies the neural circuitry of reward-seeking behavior, which, don't worry if you don't know what that means, the book takes you through all of that. But basically she studies addiction and depression, and it's at a time in her life when her own mother, who is suffering from depression, comes to stay with her. So she finds herself taking care of her mother while working toward her final thesis project, and also reflecting back on her childhood, particularly the years that led up to her beloved older brother, Nana's passing from a heroin overdose. So it's a book about difficult mother-daughter relationships. It's a book about sibling relationships. It is a book about immigration, about racism, about what we do in order to kind of make a life for ourselves after we have experienced some trauma in our younger years.
I want to talk a little bit about one other thing that it's about, and it's depression. Mm-hmm. And this search that this scientist has for whatever she's trying to find in mice that can help with humans. I kept calling this a new of Mice and Men story. So that's not what it's about. Yeah. But there is a lot of science. There is a lot. There are a lot of references. The amount of research, the archival, if we were talking about a documentary, what made you decide to include that? It really does make the book. And I learned so much. But talk a little bit about the decision that you made for this to be a contemporary novel about a woman who's really, really smart.
Yeah, I would love to talk about that. So the science really came first, and it was the thing that formed the idea. I was living in Berkeley at the time that I started writing this. I had just finished Homegoing and had just published Homegoing, rather, and one of my closest friends from childhood was getting her PhD in neuroscience at Stanford at the time, and she had a major paper that was about to be released. And she had been so supportive of me, I wanted to be supportive of her. So I sat down to read this paper and I could not understand a single sentence of it. It went completely over my head. And so really out of curiosity at that point, I didn't think I was gonna write about her work. I asked if I could go shadow her in her lab. She very generously said yes. The day that I went, she performed a surgery on her mice that I detail in the early pages of this novel. And I was just kind of hooked from there. It was so different from anything that I spent my days thinking about. And the implications that her work had on human life, I found so fascinating and really, I feel like touched upon things that I spent my days thinking about anyway, like what it means to kind of seek out pleasure, what it means to kind of seek out happiness or anything in the midst of risk, of danger. Those things felt very human to me, even though she was researching mice and thinking about mice. But the implications of it I found to be really interesting and felt like they could map themselves on quite well to a narrative. So that was the beginning of this for me. I didn't want to shy away from the science, but at the same time, I am a lay person. I hadn't taken a science class since, you know, freshman year of college. So I had to do a lot of research to get comfortable talking about it, but keeping myself in mind, keeping that awareness that I was a person who didn't know this this world and on a technical level, I think helped to write it in such a way that it's still, that science is still accessible, and you're still kind of, you're learning and you're being able to apply the things that you're learning to real lives. It was a pleasure and it felt very much like stretching new muscles for me.
Well, I had originally asked if you would read a chapter or an excerpt that had to do with the mice in the lab, but instead I wanted you to read something about the relationship between brother and sister, because it is so special and you capture these characters so amazingly. Would you read for our audience for just a minute?
Yes, I would love to. And also I should say thank you so much, Rochelle, and thank you to the National Writers Series for having me. This is wonderful.
We're thrilled.
In Hamilton and Freemau's 1985 study on the effects of cognitive behavioral training on basketball free throw performance, researchers asked three college basketball players with low game to practice free throw ratios to listen to tape recordings with instructions for deep muscle relaxation. The men were also tasked with watching videotapes of themselves playing basketball while attempting to reconstruct the thoughts they were having in each moment that played back to them. The researchers wanted them to identify any moments when they experienced negative self-evaluation and to instead try to cultivate positive self-statements. So instead of thinking, I'm the worst, I've never been good at anything in my life, how did I even make it onto this team? They were to aim for, I got this, I'm capable, I'm here for a reason. By the end of the training program, all three subjects had improved by at least 50%. I don't know what thoughts ran through Nana's mind in those days. I wish I did. Because of my career, I would give a lot to be able to inhabit someone else's body, to think what they're thinking, feel what they're feeling. For a copy of Nana's thoughts from birth to death, bound in book form, I would give absolutely anything, everything. But since accessing his mind has never been possible, I resort to speculating, assuming, feeling, modes of logic with which I have never been entirely comfortable. My guess is that it wasn't just Nana's body that couldn't sit still. He had a mind that was always thrumming. He was curious, intense, often quiet. And when he asked a question, there were 100 more lurking behind it. This constant striving for exactness, the right position for his legs, the right thing to say, was what made him someone who could shoot free throws for hours on end. But it also made him someone who had a harder time changing the narrative, getting from the negative self-statement to a positive one. When he said, I don't give a fuck what he thinks, he said it in such a way that it was abundantly clear to me that this was precisely what he cared most about. And because Nana cared deeply, thought deeply, I imagine that these things were the kinds of negative self-statements he would reconstruct if he were to have watched a video of himself playing basketball or simply living his life. It didn't hurt his game any, but it hurt him in other ways. Maybe it would have helped if we were the kind of family who talked about our feelings, who indulged in an I love you, a little abrofu kwas yesen every now and again. Instead, I never told Nana how proud I was of him, how much I loved seeing him on the basketball court. On the game days when our mother was at work, I would walk to Nana's high school to watch him play, and then I would wait for him to finish talking to the other players and come out of the locker room so that he and I could walk back home together. Good job, Nana, I would say when he finally came out in a fog of Axe body spray. Nana's coach always left as soon as the final whistle blew, so the only adult who would still be around was the night janitor, a man whom both Nana and I avoided because his job always made us think about our father. Y'all sure don't act like any siblings I've ever seen, the janitor said that one night. I mean, good job, Nana, like he's your employee or your student or something. You should be giving him a hug. Come on, man, Nana said. I'm serious, y'all don't act like you hardly know each other. Go on and give your sister a hug, he said. Nah, man, we're good, Nana said. He started walking toward the door. Let's go, Gifty, he said, but I was still standing there, looking at the janitor who was giving me a kids these days kind of head shake. Gifty, Nana shouted without turning, and I ran to catch up. I'd left our house when it was still light out, but by the time the two of us got outside, it was a hot and humid night. Fireflies flashed their greetings all around us. Nana's long strides meant I had to hustle to keep up with him, a half shuffle, half jog that I had perfected over the years. Do you think it's weird we don't hug? I asked. Nana ignored me and quickened his pace. These were the Nana ignores everyone days, when my mother and I would steal commiserating glances at each other after one of his moody groans. To Nana, my mother would say, you think you and me are size? Fix your face. To me, she would say, this too shall pass. We lived about a mile and a half away from the school, an easy walk by our mother's standards, but one we dreaded. Sidewalks in Huntsville were mostly decorative. People drove their SUVs to grocery stores two blocks away, their air conditioning on full blast. The only people who walked were people like us, people who had to walk because they had one car, one parent who worked double shifts even on game days, because walking was free and public transportation was either non-existent or unreliable. I hated the honking, the slurs yelled out through rolled down windows. Once, while I was walking by myself, a man in a pickup truck had driven slowly next to me, staring at me so hungrily, I grew afraid and ducked into the library, hid among the books until I was certain he hadn't followed me. But I liked walking with Nana on those spring nights when the weather was just starting its quick turn from pleasant to oppressive, when the cicadas' songs gave way to those of the katydids. I loved Alabama in the evenings when everything got still and lazy and beautiful, when the sky felt full, fat with bugs. Nana and I turned onto our street. One of the street lamps was out, and so there was a minute-long stretch of near darkness. Nana stopped walking. He said, "Do you want a hug?" My eyes were still adjusting to that patch of dark. I couldn't see his face, couldn't tell if he was serious or just making fun of me. But I considered the question carefully anyway. "No, not really," I said. Nana started laughing. He walked those last couple of blocks unhurriedly, at my pace, so that I could walk beside him.
Wow, wow, wow. In just those few pages, you captured the essence of a relationship between a brother and sister, of a family and their history and how they interact, of the place where they are. I mean, literally, that's one of the most amazing things, and a little science thrown in for good measure, because if I that paragraph first, like if I just walked in the bookstore and read that, I would go, oh no, this is something hard. But when you get into every bit of science that's in the book, every study, everything that you found, which helped define and helped you understand these real people, it was just amazing. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask a very odd question because it's been, you know, 5 years. Where were you when you wrote that particular passage?
I think when I wrote that particular passage, I was living in Berlin. I had received a fellowship from the American Academy in Berlin to spend 4 months working on this novel. And I had this kind of beautiful office on the lake in Wannsee. And it was the first time in my life that I had an office. And so I took great pleasure in walking down to that office and sitting at my desk and writing. And I think that I was thinking about Nana's basketball skills and that it began with me kind of just researching basketball studies or studies that had been done on basketball players. And once I read that particular study, I thought there was a way to kind of work in that idea that the messaging that we give ourselves can impact how we express ourselves. And that's how I started to create that connection.
Well, that is just stunning writing. And I'm so glad that you agreed to read that. I can't imagine anybody heard that and isn't ready to read all the rest of it, because there are so many other moments like that. I wanted to ask a little bit about when you wanted to be a writer. I'm a writer and I've been a writer since I was 8 years old, but when did you know that this was your path, that you weren't going to try science? Well, you kind of knew, but that moment where you said, no matter how I do it, that's who I am.
Yeah, I love that you started when you were eight. I also started really young. I started when I was seven, and I can remember specifically what happened, which was that I was obsessed with reading Rainbow, obsessed with LeVar Burton. I watched every day. And one year, I noticed that he was making a call for the Reading Rainbow Young Writers and Illustrators competition. And I asked my parents if I could enter. And my father had this big old clunky typewriter that he pulled out from the closet and let me type out my story. It was called Just Me and My Dog, and it was about a little girl who begs her parents for a dog, which was at that point my life story. And I sent it in to the competition, and I didn't win, but I got a certificate of achievement that was signed by LeVar Burton. And that was my most prized possession at that point. And I think that was the first time that I had ever been kind of, not just that I had written a story, but that I had seen a response come back for the story that I had written. This like first kind of validation of this work that I wanted to do. And really from that moment on, it was always somewhere in the back of my mind that I wanted to be a writer. I didn't know that writing was like a career that you could have. I wasn't, you know, treating it like more than a hobby for most of my childhood. But I think once I started to kind of accept that this was something you could do as a profession, I knew that it was what I wanted to do.
Well, you do it very well. I want to go back for just a second to the passage that you read, because it was about a brother and sister, and you mentioned, you know, there are two of you, you and your brother. Do you and your brother hug?
I actually have two brothers, and,
hug
and we do. We do. Yes, we do hug. So it's not, you know, that part is not autobiographical.
So many little moments, little details in the language, in the narrative, in some of the moments. The way you describe her mother's back lying in bed away from her, that she has to come home to that over and over and over. Are you doing that as you write, or do you go back in and put on another layer of writing on top of whatever you do the first time? Talk a little bit about the process.
I'm doing it as I write. I feel like a really kind of intuitive writer. I don't do a lot of pre-planning, even for homegoing. I didn't have an outline. So the way that I feel as though I'm going about it is that I'm kind of fumbling my way through the beginning. And the beginnings are the hardest part for me. With homegoing, I threw out probably about 100 pages that just weren't working until I like landed on the first chapter.
Well, where Transcendent... are they? I want those 100 pages.
they're buried somewhere. Transcendent Kingdom, I threw out fewer pages, but it was still a similar process. I'm always kind of starting over until I land on just the right voice, the right tone, all of those things. And once I do, really, for both books, the first chapters are almost exactly the same as when I first wrote them. They don't change much. And I'm a pretty concise and I would say precise writer. I'm not one of these writers that writes like thousands of pages and then slashes to get to the end. I try as hard as I can to have the first draft be as close to finished as possible. And so, yeah, so things like that moment that you talked about, the curve of this woman's back, the slope of this woman's back, I think that was a line that just happened as I was writing the first draft. Subsequent drafts are more, for me, kind of technically minded. I'm kind of trying to make sure things like the structure are as tight as possible, making sure that the research that I've done is as accurate as possible, is kind of bolstering the story, things like that. But the language and the kind of intuitiveness of the structure, I think, is something that I just do in the first draft. I want to attribute it to Doctorow, but it might be a different writer. But he said, that writing is like driving a car in the pitch black dark with your headlamps on. You can only see the little stretch of road in front of you, but that stretch gets you to the next stretch, which gets you to the next stretch, and eventually you get there. And that's how I feel like my process is.
Well said, and I'm glad you quoted Doctorow. For many people, whether they're professors or English teachers or people who profess to love literature, they always talk about the first line of a book, Call Me Ishmael. Mm. Your first line in this book, whenever I think of my mother, I picture a queen-size bed with her lying in it, a practiced stillness filling the room. Was that the first line that you wrote for the first line, or did you go back and come up with that?
That is the first line that I wrote for the first
I'm just
line.
Gonna quit writing. All right. So we want to end with this question. A book this great that gets that many awards and it's a saga and people love sagas, is there any chance that this is going to become a movie? Has someone already talked about it?
Oh, that's a great question. It has been optioned for, I think they want to do a television miniseries, but who knows when that will happen. Fingers crossed that it actually gets made.
Well, it's been a long, long time since I read a book that impacted me like this one did. So I can't wait to read Homegoing, because then that's going to change that. A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, Betty Smith, when I was very young. So thank you for that and for this amazing thing. Thanks everybody for joining us tonight. And I'll talk to you later, y'all, about who should play the two sisters.
Yes, please let me know.
We can't wait for the next book. Is it coming soon?
It's anyone's guess when it's coming, but hopefully not too long.
Well, we will be there when you're ready, and please come and see us in Michigan. Traverse City is lovely, four seasons a year.
Oh,
thank
wonderful.
Everyone, thank you so much for being here, and good night.
Thank you.
That was Yaa Jossi talking with Rochelle Riley, and you're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up in the second half, a discussion with Kate Walbert.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Kate Walbert's writing often focuses on women's lives, like her novel, A Short History of Women, and her latest collection of short stories, She Was Like That. Kate appeared at a virtual National Writer Series event. She spoke with Shannon Kleiber, author and producer of the public radio program To the Best of Our Knowledge. Shannon asked Kate how she decided which stories to include in the new book.
It was actually tough putting together a collection of short stories because I wanted to do new and selected works. So I had five stories that I knew I wanted as the new stories, but the selected were harder to choose. What they all have in common and what I decided made the most sense for the collection, working with my editor with this, was to two stories where women are at the center of the story. And often women in situations that are, you know, familiar situations, domestic situations, often somewhat banal situations, you know, like going to the hair salon, but that something happens that throws it off, makes it a little bit off kilter, shines a different light onto what would seem a very familiar experience. And that's what many of these stories have in common.
Do you outline very much? Do you know what's going to happen when you start a short story?
No, I have no idea what's going to happen.
No idea at all.
I often start with an anecdote or a situation. It might be a line of dialogue. It might be, you know, a funny detail that I've heard or a friend has told me, or even that I've observed myself. You know, for instance, in the title story, She Was Like That, the narrator is having a break for freedom, as she calls it. And this is something she inherited from her mother, who would take breaks for freedom. And this is something that years ago, I don't even remember who mentioned it to me, but it just, you know, when something is good like that, it hangs around. And then when you start writing, those things all of a sudden come into play. You're not setting out saying, oh, I'm going to write a story in which the woman takes a break for freedom, whatever that means. But the fact that it's lingering around, you know, means that it's good enough and you can use it in your work, and it just pops up.
Do you write those little phrases down in a notebook, or do they just, if they're that powerful, they'll stay with you?
You know, I hope, although as I get older, less and less stays with me. But no, in fact, I think it's the writer Amy Hempel. I once read that she actually has a basket on her desk where she, whether this is true or not, I'm not sure, but I heard it where she writes little phrases that she hears and she puts it in the basket. And then when she gets stuck or when she's writing, she might pull it out to get her story going. So I've often thought, well, that would be a good idea to keep a journal or to have that basket, but I've just never gotten around to doing it.
Yeah, well, maybe someday, but it works the way you do it. It obviously works the way you do it.
Thank you.
I feel like New York is kind of a character in so many of your stories. And do you feel like that sense of place is important for your characters when you put them somewhere, that they kind of grow from that? And how does the sense of place play into how you write your characters?
Well, absolutely. And thank you for describing it that way, because I really do think the setting, no matter where a story is set, that the setting does become a character. So New York is so ripe for that. So wherever I find my characters to be moving around in the city, there's always something that they can interact with. And the city itself has a certain energy. I mean, I found actually going through the stories that, and I wasn't conscious of this, but that it's often April and raining. I have no idea why. Maybe for me, New York is April and raining, but so it's not just the city, it's the weather, it's the environment as a whole. So for instance, with M&M World, the character is taking her young daughters to M&M World, which is a store that is smack in the middle. I don't know if any of the listeners can picture it or have been there, but it's smack in the middle of Times Square. It basically just occupies Times Square. So in imagining that story, Times Square really took on a life of its own for me for writing that, and kind of added to the ominous sense of that story, I think, because of the assault of that particular block, those blocks in the city, and just the lights and the images and everything, a kind of cacophony of sound. So it's as if New York is a character in that story, it's a character who's talking very loudly, you know, and pushing their way into the narrative.
M&M World is one of my favorite of your stories. And I have to say, I'm a mom of two girls. And if listeners have read it, I'm going to ask you to read a little bit of it. But it is both incredibly real and incredibly frightening, but a sense of wonder and a sense of impending doom, which is kind of amazing that you pulled all of that together in this one story. So it would be wonderful if you could read a little bit from it so the listeners can get a sense of your style and how things build in your stories.
Well, I happen to have the book right here. Okay, so this is the beginning. M&M World is the first story in the collection, and this is the beginning of that story. Ginny had promised to take the girls to M&M World, that ridiculous place in Times Square they had passed too often in a taxi. Maggie scooting to press her face to the glass to watch the giant smiling M&M scale the Empire State Building on the electronic billboard and wave from the spire, its color dissolving yellow, then blue, then red, then yellow again. She had promised. Promised, Olivia said, her face twisted into the expression she reserved for moments of betrayal. Please, Olivia whined, you said spring. She had said spring, this she remembered, and it was spring, or almost, spring enough, spring advancing, the trees newly budded, the air peppery. Regardless, it felt too early to go home when the light shone this strongly slanting across Central Park in the way of late March, early April. Plus, the city had already collectively sprung forward. All right, she found herself saying, just once, today, just once, that's it. Breaking her resolution to stop qualifying. 5 more minutes, this last page, 1 more bite, and wishing mid-speech she would stop. She has tried, just as she's tried to be more easygoing. But when push comes to shove, as it always will, she is not easygoing. And she qualifies. It's a verbal tick. First this, and then that. A constant negotiation. Action, then reward, or promise of reward. What is it that the books say? Screw the books. She takes the girl's hands and holds tight, changing course, crossing Central Park West to Central Park South. The girl suddenly delighted and delightful, straining ahead, buoyant. They are gorgeous, bright-eyed, brilliant girls, one tall, one short, pant legs dragging, torn leggings, sneakers that glow in the dark or light up with each step, boom, boom, boom. They break free and race across, bounding onto the sidewalk. Their hands rejoin like paper cutouts, zigzagging here, zigzagging there. Maggie clutching Zoom Zoom with her free hand, choking the thing, its dangly legs and arms, its floppy, flattened ears. Ginny follows them quickly, remembering how her heart would literally stop as Olivia, then what, 4, 5, would run to this same corner, the light not yet changed. Her daughter had only to step into traffic to veer off the curb. She never did. Olivia climbed the stone seals at Seal Park in Chelsea, the bronze bears in the playground outside the Metropolitan Museum. She teetered on their heads and could so easily have slipped. She did slip once, but it was nothing. Still, Jenny had to wake her every hour that night, shake her out of her sleepy fog. "Who am I?" Jenny had said. Olivia's blue princess pajamas silky beneath her grip, Olivia's shoulders so thin. "Mommy?" Olivia said, squinting. Pupils the right size, shrinking, constricting or contracting, she never knew which, but whatever, correctly, she was fine. And then a bit older, those other sneakers, Heelys, Wheelies, and Olivia careering along the sidewalk, wheels where the heels should be, the speed. And downhill too, with nothing to hold on to, no way to stop. The pediatrician had said the most dangerous thing was trampolines, even with nets. And then that rented house that summer had one netless in the backyard. She had watched as the girls bounced higher and higher. She couldn't get them off. Olivia, now Maggie, just like her big sister. She had stood vigil at the window or next to the rail in her hat and long sleeves buttoned at the wrist, the girls slathered with sunscreen. The point is, her heart stuck in her throat, always in her throat.
Wow. Reading that, my heart started racing kind of part way through because I was thinking, oh, my daughters too, you know, and I, when they're little, they're those things that you worry about. And then you worry about new things like, you know, the crossing the street, the trampoline, and then you worry about even bigger and other things as you get into in the story. And how much of it is real? I would love to hear, you know, so many people think fiction writers just meld so much of their reality into their fiction writing. How much of that story was real to you?
Well, writing it felt very real to me because, you know, the way I approach a story is that because I don't know what's going to happen, I'm sort of right there with the reader in a sense. I'm learning as I go along. I'm looking for clues. I'm looking for I'm trying to figure out who is this character? Who is Ginny? And who are her little girls? And why are they going to M&M World? And what's going to happen? And, you know, I wrote that story having never been to M&M World. it's kind of a point of pride for me because there later in the story, there's a whole riff on once they get inside the store on all the products that are for sale. And when the story was originally published, it was published in the New Yorker, and they always fact check fiction in the New Yorker. So the fact checker actually went to M&M World and fact checked it for me. And I was very happy to learn that many of the things that I thought I made up, you know, in the sense of like different products that are for sale there actually were there. But to your point about what's real, it is all of it real to me because I have to be so attuned to who my characters are, and I have to listen in a sense for the clues that I get. So for instance, you know, writing that, when I get to the point, Ginny's heart was in her throat, her heart was in her throat. And just the fact that it opens with all of these ways in which she imagines that those girls can get in trouble, not in trouble, but can get hurt. You know, they can fall, they can run out to the curb. I think it's a universal feeling, of course, for any parent. But in this case, it was so pronounced at the beginning of the story that kind of led me to what actually happens in the story, which is that one of the girls, once they get into the store, gets lost. And so there is this incredible panic of not knowing where the youngest girl is in the store. And what was interesting to me was that after it was published, I did get many notes from people who had had the experience of, you know, being in a playground and looking left instead of right, and suddenly when they look left again or right again to find their child, the child is gone for, you know, maybe 2 minutes, but that 2 minutes feels like an eternity. So just that universal feeling of losing a child in the moment. And, you know, so for M&M World, the question of how much is real, how much is not real, again, it feels very real in the moment as I'm writing it. This did not happen to me, but the challenge for me is always to be in a place with my work so that it's the world that I'm writing about is so vivid that it feels like it's, you know, you want it to feel like it's true in this weird way. Although another story in the book, Playdate, is about two women who go with their children on a playdate, and then they break into the wine and they end up really drinking a lot of wine over the course of the afternoon. And sometimes when I would read that story at readings or whatever, I would get a question about, you know, well, did you ever, you know, do you drink? So I came up with a good line, which is only on playdates.
Oh, that's funny. That's great. It is a compliment to your writing that it is so real. It feels like, you know, I read that and I thought, as a mother of two girls, there's no way she doesn't have two girls. And I, you know, although I know you have stories about having sons. So the truth is, can you tell the audience in your real life?
In my real life, I do have two girls. Yeah. You nailed it.
So, I mean, but then there are other stories. You have sons, you have, you know, that many of these stories are about the, you know, the inner life of mothers of sons and of other people and not the two girls, but the sense of reality in that, yet also magical kind of realism in a weird way too, of it wasn't quite real. And it, I don't know how you do that as a writer. I think that's so interesting. It's so true and real, but yet there's this sense of something kind of off and kind of not quite right and kind of unreal.
Right. Well, you know, again, that's not necessarily a conscious choice when I'm writing. It's just, I think the way that I make the situation interesting for me and interesting for my characters. I want to see what happens when something goes askew. I want to see how it changes that environment. Again, an environment that's often a very predictable one, or one feels that it's predictable or known, right? But what happens if you introduce an element of the surreal or even gothic? You know, it's scary. It can be scary. You kind of put a little tear in the facade and you say, okay, I'm going to rip this open a little bit and let's see what happens. What happens in that moment, in that situation? And I think what I hope to get to is a reason that the story is being told, right? I mean, why is this story even being told? And so I think to get there is to find in that situation something that feels like a moment of clarity for the character, which is which again speaks to, well, that's why the story is being told. You know, if I only had one, you know, I'm speaking as Ginny, the character in M&M World. If I only had one story to tell you, that story would be about the day that I lost my daughter in M&M World. You know, it's got to feel like, it's got to feel that important. It's got to be that much pressure in it. So what is that? What causes that? What causes that moment of clarity? When do we get those moments? And I think often those moments come when you are in a situation and something alters it. So it's not normalized anymore. I don't even know if you can say you learn something from it. I don't know if you necessarily learn something from it, but if you're asked, tell me the moments of your life, you know, tell me what's important, what comes back to you, it would be one of those moments. And that's what I hope to get to.
You totally do that. And something that I think is really interesting about what you do in your character development is you put these characters in kind of a normal situation, but then you get inside their heads. You really, when most, you know, we're talking mostly about these particular stories, they're mothers, they're women, and you really bring out how women think and how women react to the world. Are you doing that consciously and thinking, okay, this is what I mean to be doing?
It's not a conscious effort. It's not a conscious effort toward a theme or even an idea that I'm trying to get across. I think it's just really, again, you know, trying to be with the character in that world, in that fictional world. And I guess, you know, I'm a woman in the world. So in a sense, it's filtered through my own observations and my own way of being in the world. So, you know, that of course is going to be a factor that's going to come through. But what's most interesting to me is to put these characters in these situations and see how they react. So actually, thank you. I mean, it's really nice to hear that it feels familiar, or it feels like it has a resonance, because that's really what it comes down to too. I mean, when I say the thing about, you know, in the moment, this is the moment you go back to, the moment you think of, if you had to explain, you know, something about your life, well, that's really that we're talking about moments that are resonant moments. And so that's what I hope to get to in a story. And if it resonates with a reader, well, then that's, you know, that's the gold ring. I mean, that's what you want. But I think in writing them, it's about engaging with the character and the story, as opposed to trying to advance any kind of idea or theme across to the reader. That's how I experience writing.
And part of what I think works so well is dialogue. You are incredible at writing the dialogue of these characters. And I was wondering how you, do you kind of listen to people as you're walking by, or you have an ear for conversation and how people really talk?
No, thank you. No, I'm a terrible eavesdropper. Terrible. Just really like
you're not writing down all these things that people say.
I'm not writing them down. I'm just listening. And again, much of it just goes in one ear and out the other. But it's hard, I think, for my family to go out to dinner with me or to anyone, because I'm constantly like, oh, you're not really paying attention to what the next table is talking about, because it's far more interesting than what we're having a conversation.
You are eavesdropping.
That I will admit to. So yes, I think it's just, and it's practice too. I think, you know, one thing I find really interesting about dialogue and writing dialogue, and I probably err on the side of this, is that if you really listen to the way that people speak, it's very rare that people are exchanging information. So I find that when I'm writing, when I get to dialogue, if I'm stuck, or if it begins to sound a little flat to me, then I might throw in a line that really has nothing to do with what they're talking about, just to see what that line will do to the story, to make it more mysterious for me. I think if you were to say, okay, I'm going to do this exercise of having two characters talk to one another, but they're not going to say anything. They're just going to talk to each other, but they're not going to say anything of meaning. It's not going to be, you know, I went to the grocery store. No, you didn't. You forgot the milk. You know, that kind of back and forth. And it's truly remarkable if you give yourself that exercise, what you can come up with. Because I do think that in a way, it's not necessarily even a conscious decision, but we have a way when we're writing that we want to make sense of things. So even if you try to do this exercise where you have dialogue and it's not saying anything, somehow it's going to come around and say something. It's going to reveal something about your characters to you, just in the quirk or a tick or something that you might not have noticed before that you couldn't have necessarily put in there. And certainly you couldn't have put in there through information.
That's really interesting. I was actually going to ask you if you had advice for people who were starting to write fiction or who are writing fiction and they could use a little, you know, here are a couple things. I mean, that's what you're saying about the exercise for dialogue is a great starting point. But what else would you say to people who are working on fiction right now?
Oh, well, along those lines, a great exercise that I love to do is you put together two extremely unlike things, you know, that have nothing to do with each other. And then you write and try to make sense of it. So, you know, I don't know, her hair was made of spaghetti, you know, something. And you just keep going until somehow you come around and you've made sense of what is a nonsensical sentence to start it off with. So that's a fun one to do. The other one I like as an exercise is to try to write a 2-page long, grammatically correct. You have to throw in the grammatically correct because it always throws people off. 2-page long, grammatically correct sentence, singular. And that one is a great one to give because what it does is it forces you as the writer not to go off subject. You can't go anywhere with that sentence. You just have to keep digging deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper into the sentence. And again, it's amazing what you come up with when you set out and you don't have a preconceived idea of where you want to go. I mean, all of these things really go back to that idea that you don't have a preconceived set notion of where whatever it is you're writing is going to go. Because that way, then the writing itself can teach you where it wants to go.
It's wonderful. But thank you, Kate, so much. It's been such a pleasure to get to know you and talk with you. And it's been a great conversation. And thanks again.
Thank you.
That was Kate Walbert talking with Shannon Kleiber. Kate's latest collection of short stories is called She Was Like That. In the first half of the program, we heard from Yah Jassy talking with Rochelle Riley. Yah's latest novel is Transcendent Kingdom. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.